A Biblical Theory of Marriage, the first talk in a series entitled Understanding and Living with the Dynamics of Sex, was presented by Jack Crabtree, Ron Julian, and Nancy Scott on September 26, 2007, at McKinsey Study Center's Wednesday night class. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2007. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
This is not going to be our traditional lecture followed by question and answer format. So, don't know how this is going to work. I hope it's going to work. Something like this has worked in the past, and I hope it works again. It's going to be a conversation, but obviously with this many people, it has to be a guided, controlled conversation. So I will be the air traffic controller of the conversation. We're taping this, so if you have something to say, I will hand you the microphone. And so we'll try to have a microphone in front of everybody who's making a comment. I've created and produced some notes here with some of my thoughts and my thinking to guide the conversation, to give you something to interact with. So here's how this is going to work. Here are the ground rules. I'll make some comments. So, yeah. Ron and Nancy will use these. They are here to help me by contributing to the flow of the discussion. And then I'm inviting all of you, staff and attendees, all of you, with any questions, comments, contributions, observations that you want to make that advance the conversation. You know, hopefully don't change the subject, but if you're advancing the conversation, that I invite you at any point and just get my attention somehow and I will get the mic to you. So hopefully that's clear. Just feel free to participate in this conversation. But to get things started, I want to lay out what I would understand from my study of the scripture is what I would call a biblical theory of marriage. And I will get partway into it, and at any point that where I'm at in the outline it stimulates a question or an observation or something, then feel free to get my attention and make your contribution. The place to start, I think, is to recognize what a radical difference there is between a biblical worldview and everything that is and everything that represents on the one hand, and a more modern naturalistic worldview. The biblical worldview, because we believe, we who believe in the authority of the Bible and the teaching of the Bible, the biblical worldview is that there's a creator God who's a rational being as well as a good being, who created the world and created everything in it and every aspect of the world with a particular purpose, with a particular intent. And it's what philosophers would call the cosmos is teleological in nature. That is, the things in the world have a particular end or purpose that they fail to fulfill. And because the structure of reality is teleological, it makes sense to a Christian, somebody from a biblical worldview, to ask questions like, what is sexuality for? What is marriage for? Why did God have male and female and this thing called marriage where a man and woman get together and commit their lives to each other and so on? Why? And we expect that there should be an answer to that question. From a naturalistic point of view, that whole worldview is that whatever is, if biologically human beings are male and female, okay, that's a fact. Biologically, males are male and female. Why? So what? What do we do with that? Well, whatever we want to. From the naturalistic modern point of view, there's no right or wrong with what you do with the fact that there is male and female. You just do with it whatever you decide to do with it, whatever you in your freedom decide you want to try. Well, that's a decisive and fundamental and radical difference between the biblical worldview and the modern worldview. Our culture has been, especially when it comes to the area of sexuality, I would argue, our culture has been completely and totally captivated by that modern naturalistic worldview. And that's why there's so much tolerance and freedom and thought about being creative about what we do with our sexuality today. Anything goes in a significant sense. Well, why are the biblical Christians such stick-in-the-muds about that? Well, because we don't believe in that kind of universe. We believe that there is a purpose and a design and a structure and a meaning to everything that is, and we're trying to live our lives in the light of that fact and make our lives conform to the purpose and meaning and significance of that which is. So when it comes to marriage in the naturalistic worldview, what is sexuality? It's just a physical animal instinct and a desire that has, for whatever reasons, because evolution brought it to pass, just is. What is marriage then? Marriage is something that human beings invented a long time ago, and for some reason is still with us. But it's this human artifact, this human institution, and maybe the more hip and enlightened of us will get past it and beyond it here shortly, and we'll be able to leave marriage behind. But in the meantime, it's this tradition that we're stuck with. Human beings have invented this thing. And why did they invent it? Because sexuality is such a powerful force, a powerful desire, a powerful yearning. And in order to not have it be socially disruptive, we invent this thing called marriage to try to control it and channel it and keep it in check. But at any point, we could reinvent it if we wanted to. We don't have to have marriage. We don't have to be married. So, according to naturalistic assumptions, sex is the biological given. Marriage is created by man to serve the social purposes that man has decided are his purposes. We want to keep this under control, this sex thing. The biblical worldview is radically different when it comes to marriage. The unique relationship of marriage has been created by God with a particular design and a particular purpose. Marriage can't be reinvented without rebelling against or revolting against God's will and God's intention and God's purpose for marriage. And according to God's design, then, marriage is the given. Sex, I'm going to argue, when we get to a theory of sex next week, I think it is, or the week after that. Sex is created by God to serve the purposes of marriage. So that's a fundamentally different perspective than you'll find anywhere else in this culture. That what's most important in the difference between male and female is that we are created male and female in order to be married, enter into this strange institution called marriage. Why sex? Well, it has a role to play. It has a function to play within that relationship that we'll talk about. But sex is not the ultimate. Sex is not primary. Sex is not what makes the world go around. Sex is not what defines the relationship between male and female. It's marriage that defines the relationship. And sex only plays one particular role in that. Okay, what I would argue then is that from a biblical perspective, what's the purpose of marriage? Well, the purpose of marriage is not unlike the purpose of many, many things in human existence. It's fundamentally to be its own unique and particularly intense classroom or training ground for human beings to learn what it means to be a human being before their creator. It's a place in which we can learn wisdom. It's a place in which we can learn what righteousness is and what the implications of that are. It's a place where we can learn what faith in our Creator is and what the implications of that are. And it just happens to be a particularly important and intense classroom and training ground. And I will. My argument would be that's its primary function. So the primary function of marriage is not to make me happy, even though I would argue that there's a very, very special and unique joy and reward that marriage has to offer. But that's not why marriage is a part of human experience. Marriage is a part of human experience because, like so many other things in human experience, it only belongs to this age, this physical age, this world that we live in now. as a place to learn what it means to be a creature before our Creator. To love Him, to know Him, to serve Him, to honor Him, our Creator. And it's in the context of marriage where there are particularly challenging aspects to marriage that make that an important learning ground, training ground for that. So one of the most common mistakes that our culture makes is to think of marriage as something that's going to fulfill me. I mean, anyone who's ever been married knows that marriage ultimately ends up being disappointing in that regard. When you're young, you don't understand that. When you're young, you expect that if only I could get married, if only I could find that person who loves me and is committed to me for life, then my life will be full. It really doesn't matter who they are, what a fine woman it is or what a fine man it is. It really doesn't matter who they are. The longing of my heart, the yearning of my heart is for something more than a wife or husband can satisfy. So there's so much disappointment in our culture that comes from a kind of mythology and a kind of account and story of marriage that gets given that sets us up to believe that all my problems are going to be solved. I will never be lonely again. I will never be unhappy again if I can just find that right person and be married to them. Well, you do find that right person and you do marry them and life is still empty. And I have to confront the reality of the emptiness of life as it is in this world and in partnership with somebody who's a great person that I love and am committed to. But it still hasn't satisfied all of my needs and all of my wants. So there are a lot of people then, because of the mythology of our culture, they confront the emptiness of marriage in that regard, and then they decide, well, what happened is I married the wrong person. And there are people who get divorced because they are unhappy, because they believe the reason they're unhappy is it's just the wrong woman or it's just the wrong man. And then they get married again to another wrong woman or wrong man, and perhaps again to another wrong woman or wrong man. And again, the fact of the matter is it doesn't matter who you marry, that's not really going to be the answer to your loneliness, aloneness, significance, and so on. Now, having said all that, I'm not denying for a second that there's nothing more important in my life under the sun than my wife and my relationship with my wife. It's an incredibly rewarding relationship, as I think designed by God to be that. But as rewarding as it is, it's only rewarding as something in this world can be rewarding, and I wasn't made for this world. I was made for the world to come. And so nothing in this world can really be rewarding enough that it's going to satisfy that human longing. Let me pause there for any additional comments that you want to make or questions, or you guys want to... Walter?
I'm being a little nitpickety with this. I'm being a little nitpickety, but I'm just this last statement. The primary purpose of marriage is to create the arena in which growth and holiness is to occur. I mean, it seems like you're saying that's the arena for that, as opposed to an arena for that.
No, I mean, yeah, thank you.
And okay. So it's, I guess, the point of that statement just makes it seem almost trivial. Like its purpose is to. It has the same purpose as the rest of life, perhaps. Okay, fair enough.
I'll put this on the tape. No, you're right. I didn't mean to imply that it's the arena. It is only an arena. It would be trivial to make the point that it's just an arena for our growth and holiness if it weren't that it's up against all this mythology about the counter proposals about what... Yeah, exactly. Where people are looking for marriage to be, you know, actually the fulfillment of their existence. So all I'm really saying is, well, no, it's not the fulfillment of existence. It's like the rest of life. It won't fulfill you in the way that we expect and have come to believe. So, yeah, that's a good point. Richard?
Well, excuse me, maybe expanding on it, but I think marriage is kind of a unique relationship. I said I think marriage is kind of a unique relationship because if you look carefully at it, almost every aspect of our life gets tested. And I said I think every part of our life gets tested in that. And it's kind of interesting that it's something that when you really try to have a good marriage is one of the hardest things to do, but one of the most attractive things for people. And I'm kind of wondering if that's one of the reasons why God did this, because this is something that highly attractive to us, but at the same time, if you want it to work, it requires a lot of humility and patience. And one thing that I heard that I want to kind of relate is one man said it's not so amazing that adults have children, it's that children turn us into adults. And there's a lot in marriage that does that. I mean, they're not going to always be beautiful. They're not always going to be handsome. They're not always going to be those things that initially attracted you. And I think in many relationships, what started out as kind of the attractants, not that they are less important, but they play less of an emphasis as your relationship grows. And it's almost like a foundation. And it's, I kind of wonder, again, if God used this to kind of put us in these type of relationships to help us to grow and actually become adults.
And were you primarily talking about children or each other in a marriage relationship? Okay. Okay, good idea. So, Richard, were you talking about children or one another? Yeah, at one point you mentioned children, and I...
Really both.
Because okay, yeah. Just the whole set of relationships.
Yeah, the whole set. Marriage, because while children are not present in every marriage,
right.
I think that where they are, it becomes part of the relationship. Because, one, you're having to be very patient and mature to deal with individuals who can't take care of themselves.
Yeah.
And your goal is, once you love them and you care for them, is to let them go.
Yeah.
And there's anxiety about when you get them and then when they leave.
And yeah, for me, the real growth came from not learning to be patient with my wife and children, but watching them have to be patient with me. I mean, you learn a lot about yourself when you see your own failure.
I wasn't talking about it one way.
Yeah, no, I understand.
Okay, so I might be getting ahead of you, or this might be totally irrelevant, but this is what I'm thinking. As you were saying that, I was thinking of relationships that I know of that aren't at all in the context of Christianity and not even anything close to the type of worldview that I aspire to, but relationships where they wouldn't, really, really healthy relationships and really good relationships where the person wouldn't, they don't think it's the wrong person, and they probably never will think it's the wrong person. I don't know. How do you address that? I mean, are they fulfilled because they are still growing and maturing through each other, even though it's completely out of the context of what we would consider like a biblical worldview?
Okay, maybe I have misled you. Marriage is not fulfilling because it's not working. Marriage is not fulfilling because even when it's working, it's not enough. You understand what I'm saying?
Yeah, but I...
So I think it's Luther made this point with respect to marriage, that he understands one of the purposes of marriage to be that as we come to experience love from one another and commitment to one another, as wonderful as it is and as rewarding as it is, it can only be an anticipation of God's commitment and love for us. It's not the same. And so it can be something that gives us a taste for that which only God can fulfill. So even the best marriage, where they are really well matched and are committed to each other and love each other and serve each other and so on, still, unless they are blind to their own real needs and desires and longings, it's going to ring hollow compared to the real yearnings of their heart.
Yeah, and I mean, that's kind of the type of situation I'm thinking of, and I can imagine it not just with marriage, but I mean, people finding what they think what is like a false fulfillment in a lot of different arenas, their job or their mm-hmm. kids or, you know,
mm-hmm.
so it's just false, fake.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Well, and I was just going to add to that exactly, it can work for a while. Any of those things that fulfill us can be really great and good, and marriage can be good and very compatible and growth producing, and it's still not enough, I think, is what it comes down to. And so it's and when you talk about other things that we can pursue, the same thing is true. It can last for a while or can satisfy for a while, but there's something bigger, there's something deeper. So I appreciate that clarification, because it isn't that it's that marriages are by definition bad marriages. Really good marriages are still difficult if we want it to be something it can't be.
Thanks. Just one more clarification on that. My understanding of what you would think about a non-believer in a marriage is that there could be a lot of good in it, a lot of maturity, a lot of emotional health, a lot of self-sacrifice, a lot of truly good things, but if they don't eventually come to a place that they're being drawn to something more, and that they're coming up against the reality that they were made for something more, then that shows them not to be children of God. Not that they're not drawn to goodness at all. They could be drawn to a lot of goodness and just not be willing to be a creature, or not at a certain point refusing reality. But it doesn't mean that all the things that you see are good in their relationship are fake. There could be some really good things in them. It's just that they are refusing something else, or I'm stopping now.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think you said it. You're absolutely right. I would agree. I think the Christian culture that I grew up had a tendency to sort of take the perspective that everything goes better with Jesus. So you can't really have a real marriage unless you have Jesus. You can't really have a real whatever, that Jesus is the amplifier that makes everything worthwhile. I don't think that's true. I mean, it's human beings who get married. And whether they're believers or not believers, we were made for that kind of relationship, and some people give themselves to it and commit themselves to it, and they have fantastic marriages. My point is not that I'm not at all taking the perspective that marriage is great, but come to Jesus and then you'll really have a great marriage and you'll really be fulfilled. That's not my point. We're not going to be fulfilled in this lifetime at all, even with a great marriage, is my point. And
even with Jesus.
Yeah, even with Jesus. In fact, in some ways, especially with Jesus, you won't have a great existence here and now, because he raises problems that you wouldn't otherwise have to deal with. Did that make sense?
I guess I don't know if this is off the topic, but I guess I want to talk about divorce. And I was wondering, is it possible that two people who are married, is there a place for them to separate for the good of both of them, and that they are both in good standing with God, or that came to my mind because I've seen people leave churches for the sort of the benefit of everybody, and so that's some way a divorce.
He hands it to me. He gets to talk about the joy and all of that stuff. Well, I don't want to. I think we're going to. Are we going to talk about the. No, we're not going to talk about that. Oh, okay. I am. Well, okay, I think we have to back up to the point that Jack made at the beginning. One of the passages that, to me, actually has a lot to say about marriage and how we think about it is that place in the Gospels where Jesus is being pressed by the Pharisees on the question of divorce. And, you know, hey, look, Moses said, you know, give her a certificate of divorce, but you can't get remarried to her if she's married somebody else and that stuff. And Jesus' answer to them is to turn away from the passage about divorce and look back to Genesis and talk about what the purpose of marriage was, which is the kind of thing that Jack is trying to talk about tonight. And so it seems to me that the way we think about divorce ultimately has to be, because this is what Jesus said, is you haven't understood yet. You can't really understand what Moses was talking about when he allowed for the granting of a certificate of divorce if you don't understand what sort of thing marriage is to begin with. From God's perspective, what did he make it to be? And in his description of the two lives becoming one flesh, which Jack hasn't gotten to in his notes yet here, but what Jesus' comment about that in the end, what God has put together, let no one take apart, what he's speaking to is, if you want to know how I ought to think about marriage and how I ought to think about divorce, I have to think about it in terms of what was God's purpose, what did God want for this thing. So it seems that Jesus is painting a picture that there is a moral commitment in marriage. We are coming together to make this life together, and this is by God's design and purpose that these two people come together. And in doing so, in making one life, it is intended to be one life. And if I were to rip it apart, I would be going against what God has designed. A church relationship is a group of believers who believe that they can come together and work well together to encourage each other and promote the gospel and so on. And it might be that someone might decide, you know, we look at things differently enough or whatever, that it might be better if we were not here and over here. And you could part amicably, and all that would not be going against the purpose of God, I would say, because he didn't make a particular congregation of believers to be one flesh. But he did make man and woman, husband and wife, to be one flesh. And so for me to say, this isn't working out, we would be happier if we were apart. It may very well be true that we would be happier if we were apart. But that's not taking into account the fact that God has joined us together to be one life. So it all depends on what you mean by being okay with God, you know, right standing with God and everything. Yeah, I mean, this is where Moses' certificate of divorce comes in. Jesus says, because of the hardness of your hearts. This is why Moses allowed for the certificate of divorce. The fact is that we are not righteous people, and it can come to a place where the person I am married to does not want to be married to me anymore. I mean, they have turned away. I don't want you. In fact, I want somebody else, or whatever might have happened in that spot. The reality of human sin and our lives as human beings is that sometimes a marriage falls apart. It's just not one flesh anymore. What I think we can't say is that ethically, God's okay with that. If it didn't work out, then let's split it up. In terms of the worldview, I have to recognize that as this is not what God meant for the marriage. No divorce, I don't think any divorce can happen without there being a violation of the will of God somewhere in the midst of that. But then we have to back up. This is a really big topic, but I don't want to leave it there without saying that I think the church has fallen into the trap of thinking that Jesus, in specifying what a serious thing marriage was, that his purpose was almost to define divorce as the unforgivable sin or something like that, which is not at all, I think, what his purpose was. The Pharisees that he was talking to, they would look, their whole approach was to say, look, if it says it's okay in the law, then it's okay. So their approach was, look, Moses said you could have a certificate of divorce, so I'm just doing what the law said, so God would be cool with that, right? What Jesus is trying to get them to see is, you know, you're married to this woman, and you decide you want that one. If you slept with her right now, you think, I would be committing adultery. I know what I'll do. I'll give her my wife a certificate of divorce, which is what Moses said was okay, and then I'll sleep with her. Now it's all right because I've kept the law. And Jesus was saying to them, well, but you're just basically committing adultery legally. I mean, that's what you've basically done. So what he's speaking to is that attitude that would say, if I dissolve my marriage, I can do that legally and God will think I'm great. You know, that's what he wants us to confront. But the fact is that divorces happen, and divorced believers do not become pariahs who have committed more sin than the people who are still married. I mean, it's not like that. It's just, I have to confront the fact there has been a failure here. And what do you do with moral failure? You turn to God and ask for forgiveness and redemption. So,
and I guess my follow-up question would be, on what grounds would divorce be an option?
You're just trying to get us in trouble. All right. I admit it.
Want to address that?
No. David does not want to address it. That's a hard question, I think. Go ahead.
I can ask an easy question if you
no,
want.
No. It all comes back to that thing about, like, that we see Jesus as somehow having spelled out, here are the rules, and as long as you keep the rules, you're good, and if you violate the rules, you're bad. And what's the rule? I can divorce you if you've committed adultery. Then I can divorce with impunity, and I'm free. I didn't do anything wrong. Mm-hmm. But if you didn't commit adultery, and I divorce you, then the rules say I'm bad. And I just don't think that's the way Jesus meant to spell it out, that it's more... What he's talking about is fundamentally this idea that if I think that I can part with this from this person so that I can be with this person over here, that there is a kind of internal moral adultery going on. I think the grounds ultimately become, if I am seeking to be married, I am not at fault if the other person has stopped being married to me. And adultery is kind of the key indicator that I've left you and I'm with somebody else. I think the basic thing is, as far as it depends on me, I am trying to preserve my marriage. But there comes this point when the marriage is dead because the other person will not be married to me. And at that point, I think, what can I do? I mean, this marriage is now dead, and that's what the certificate of divorce that Moses was talking about is all about. So, in one sense, there are no grounds for divorce. As a Christian, I'm committed to maintaining my marriage. But on the other hand, the grounds for divorce are my marriage is dead. That's how I would look at it.
Go ahead. Can I ask one final question that sure. I'm done? At what point are two people married?
Can we save that till I define your
sure.
Well, I just would add, I think Ron did a really good job on that. I would just add that I would want to layer in the part that I think we can easily, in some scenarios, see someone is leaving the marriage, and therefore I am without blame if the person leaves me for another person, for example. But I think it's always appropriate to look at how did I fail this marriage. And until I turn the mirror on myself and understand that if I were a different sort of person, I could have loved well enough to make this work. That's the rub, is that I'm not a different kind of person. And that's another way that God pushes us into recognizing just how broken we are. And so I think divorce does recognize a death in a very profound way. But I think it would be a mistake to kind of have a rule that says this person is the one that left. It's never that easy.
Okay. That's all I wanted to say. Yeah, I agree with that. I just want to add, it all depends on, I guess the thing that I was addressing was, can I say, okay, this person is leaving me, the marriage is over, divorce is, I mean, this division has happened. You're right, I have to look at my own contribution to the problem. And in fact, if any of you have ever had the opportunity to talk to people who are having marriage trouble, one of the things you'll notice is that both of the people involved are experts on the problems of the other person. They can tell you in great detail what the problem of the other person is, and they're very, very kind of reluctant to acknowledge that they have been contributing to this problem as well. Because, I mean, that's kind of irrelevant. I mean, yeah, okay, I'm not perfect, but they did this. And it's so easy for that. I mean, that just happens in just pretty much every situation like that I've ever been in. We all play that game, and especially in that, the heat of that disunity, it's so easy to think about the other person's problems and not mine. So, yeah, I think rather than thinking about what's the rule for divorce or not, what we need to turn our attention to is what do I need to learn about myself, and what do I need to confess to God, and what do I need to think about and be rescued from. In the end, that's the more important.
And in that process, my marriage may still fail, but there's something bigger than marriage going on, and that's my soul and how I respond to failure and how I respond to my lack of ability to make this work with this person. So I'm not saying that if I could love better, they would know how to love okay and then we'd do okay. It's not that simple either, but it's just very complex and very difficult to watch people do this. And one thing that I think is sometimes helpful is to recognize that when I stand before God, he's not going to say, "So she was really like that. No wonder you couldn't do that." You know what I'm saying? And I think that's how we really have to look at it, is this is between me and God, because ultimately the commitment in marriage is a commitment before God to be a particular kind of person toward this person in front of me. And it's a commitment toward God that I have to really work out. Does that make sense?
Backing way up to your original question, just very briefly. If we change the question from right and wrong, which gets confusing for the reasons that Ron spelled out, is that marriage is never good. It's never right in that
divorce.
Sense. I'm sorry.
Marriage is
divorce.
Good.
It's never right.
Get a T-shirt made with that. Marriage is never good.
Divorce is never good. But change it to valid. Is it ever valid? And what church culture has tended to do is to read Jesus' statements as if the Pharisees come to him and says, "Moses instructs us to give a certificate of divorce. What do you say, Jesus?" And we would have Jesus answer, "No, he didn't. No, he didn't. Moses didn't do that. It's never valid. He can't do it. We're Christians. We can't get divorced." as if there can never, ever, ever, ever be a validity to it. Jesus' point is not that it's never valid. Jesus' point is that it's never good. You see the distinction I'm making? It's always a symptom of something gone awry in the human heart, our sin manifesting itself. But Moses recognized, and Jesus is saying, yeah, he's right. Human sin ravages human existence and relationships sometimes, and so destroys a marriage relationship that the only thing left to do is to give it a death certificate, and that's what divorce is. So marriage can be valid sometimes, even though it's never good. Sorry. You know what I mean. You know.
That's what Nancy and I are up here for.
Yeah. We're the editors.
Okay, I really do want to hear the rest of this outline, but I had a really quick question for Nancy, back to what you said about the point is, in that situation, we want to turn the mirror on ourselves and look at ourselves, and you said, if I'd been able to love differently, it would have come out. You don't mean, like, in this world differently, you mean, like, I'm sinful, right? So, like, right. not I could
exactly.
have figured this out
right.
and made it work.
And if I could have loved better, then they would have been able to love me back.
Right.
I'm not saying that.
It's more like if I was I don't know, not a sinful being.
What I want to highlight there is that what it needs to highlight in my own experience is that I also have failed.
Right.
In this marriage. If this marriage fails, I too am at fault. Even if I'm in the role of being victimized.
Right.
On some level by the spouse.
And just to highlight how perverse this gets, the attitude that we can sometimes take in Christian culture, I have been in situations where there has been, it can go either way, a husband to a wife or a wife to a husband, where a Christian wife or a Christian husband will be doing everything they can to drive the other person to adultery so that they can legally divorce them. I mean, morally, divorce them according to Scripture. That's perverse. I mean, that's just totally, completely evil. And yet, by the way we interpret those passages, it's completely consistent with what we think Jesus was teaching, is that I can be the innocent partner if I don't commit adultery, and they're going to be the guilty partner if they commit adultery. When you reduce it to rules, that's the kind of bizarre stuff that you start playing out. Okay.
I think that we could talk about this forever, and we don't want to, but I want to put one more piece in as far as the complexity, that it could be that as I'm looking at my faults and my failures, that it could be as I move towards righteousness that I move towards divorce. If it is a dead marriage, for example, if I am being beaten or I mean that's rather simple. I mean there could be real evil in the marriage, annihilation. That to choose what is right, it could be choosing to acknowledge this is not healthy, this is not right, and I am submitting to the fact that we do not have a marriage. And I still get to look at the fact that I responded with hatred to evil, that I, you know, and all those things. That's what my whole life is about. I get to look at how I fail in not being the person that I want to be, and that God will make us one day. But it can be that complex. And the other person could be saying, well, I don't want to get divorced. The person who is, so with their words, they're saying they want life, but they don't want life.
That's an excellent point. It probably wouldn't always sell well today, but I think you're absolutely right. Terry, there are some out there. Just a last few comments on divorce so that we don't get totally stalled there, but
hey Jack, just a quick question for you on the issue of divorce though.
Shout.
Can you hear me now?
Shout.
Alright, my question is, in the prophet Micah, where God tells him to go divorce Israel and she became a harlot of some sort, and then he also said to go back and reconcile her to him, wouldn't that right there disprove that divorce itself isn't right, period, even if it's done? It may be valid to an extent, but even then, you've lost part of your soul in a sense?
Well, I would hesitate. I think you're talking about Hosea. The prophet Hosea,
sorry.
I think it would be very dangerous to take any teaching on divorce from that, because what he's asking Hosea to do is not even about marriage. He's living out a prophecy to Israel at that point. And so there's all kinds of things that are unhealthy and abnormal about that relationship that Hosea has with his wife. That's not your normal standard ideal marriage. And yet the reason for that is because God is saying, you're not being my people in the way that would be healthy and right and good. And this is symbolizing that or picturing that.
Is your point, Reed, though, if we saw divorce as somehow an absolute evil, the act of divorce as an absolute evil, then God couldn't have asked Hosea to divorce in that? Is that
That wasn't
point?
Exactly, but I guess that would be a part of the question.
Oh, well, I don't put words in your mouth. That was...
Because okay. Also, the reason why I would say it's... I even question its validity, even in certain circumstances, because doesn't in Deuteronomy it speaks of it being an unclean act, not just a sinful act, and it goes on how it affects within the marriage family and how it affects people within the marriage?
Adultery, do you mean?
Well, not just that, but maybe children or, well, specifically children, I guess.
I can't actually hear it.
Oh, sorry. That we should we should talk more about that sometime. The notion of uncleanness in the Old Testament is a tricky one to use. Again, it's for deciding on general ethics, because there's a lot that there are things in the Old Testament that are prohibited because they're immoral, and then there are things that are prohibited in the Old Testament because they are they symbolize something, they are ritually unclean. And you always have to confront that issue when you're looking at something in the Old Testament. I mean, we're told not to wear two different kinds of fabrics. Is that inherently immoral to do that? And I think most of us could recognize, no, it's not inherently immoral. But it was a part of the covenant that God made with Israel. You are going to enact these symbolic, righteous things having to do with holiness. But on the other hand, not every moral commandment in the Old Testament is symbolic either. Some of it is rooted in abiding eternal moral principles, like how God intended marriage to be, and so on. So it's just tricky. You have to actually look at each case and ask what was the purpose of this particular thing. So that's a little tricky.
I'm sorry. I think I want to cut this off right here because the topic is marriage, not divorce. And so I want to get to the notes on the definition of marriage, if we could, and have that discussion before we run out of time. So on page 2, we get to the definition of marriage. Did I misspeak again?
No.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Julian, that was a good question. There was no problem
with that. Oh, I see. In Genesis, he gives what I take to be a biblical definition of marriage. Therefore, he says, a man shall leave his father and mother and shall cleave to his wife, and the two will become one flesh. And it seems to me that there's two, he's outlining or highlighting two different aspects to the marriage relationship. The leaving father and mother in order to cleave to the wife is one, and the becoming one flesh is the other. But before I spell out what I think he means by those two things, the crucial thing to understand is, Ron kind of already alluded to it, I would understand marriage to be a moral obligation that I'm taking on, a moral obligation, as Nancy said, before God. That is, what makes somebody married, and I think you asked the question, when does marriage happen? when marriage happens is when I make a promise to a woman, or the woman makes, and a woman makes a promise to me, I will leave father and mother and cleave to you, and I will be one flesh with you. When we take on that, when we make that covenant, that promise to one another, and feel a moral obligation before God to follow through on that, that's what marriage is. Again, we get really weird about this passage. Leaving father and mother, cleaving to wife, and becoming one flesh. We get all spooky there, as if one flesh is, you know, Casper the friendly ghost meets Caspera the friendly ghost, and they merge their, you know, they merge their essences somehow. And I mean, we just get weird. But the one flesh, I think, simply means our flesh is our physical existence in this world. That's what a flesh is. I think that's the way it is meant there. That my physical existence in this world is going to be lived so completely and totally in, is going to be so completely shared with you, my wife, that we are living one life existence together rather than living two separate and independent life existences. We're not going to exist on parallel tracks. We're just going to share one life together. Well, that's the one flesh that he's talking about. Well, it's a promise to do that is one of the promises that we are making when we make this promise of marriage. And we can talk about and you can discuss what all the implications of that are. But I think that's one of the huge ones. And then the second one is the part about leaving father and mother and cleaving to wife. Notice he's writing this in the midst of a highly patriarchal society. And notice that he says it's the husband leaves father and mother to cleave to the wife and not the other way around. I think the reason for that is to say it that way in a patriarchal society is to talk about how mutual it is. We are both promising to leave father and mother in order to cleave to one another. And I think what he's getting at there is in marriage, I'm promising to make my wife or husband the most, the highest human loyalty. I am loyal to no other person below God other than my wife or my husband. And that's what we're promising to the other person. That's the reward of marriage, and that's the challenge of marriage. It's why marriage is so desperately difficult, and it's why marriage is so desperately wonderful at the same time. It's so wonderful because it meets a very, very deep longing that we have to be significant, to be special to somebody else. That's what we long for in this world. And in marriage, you have someone saying, I promise you, you are going to be special to me. That you will have that kind of specialness in my existence. So you will have the opportunity to experience yourself as special in that way because I promise to make you feel special in that way. Now, we don't always keep that promise, and we are very clumsy in keeping that promise. But that's the ideal that we set before ourselves and say, I promise that I'm going to work to do that and learn how to do that. Maybe I'll just leave it at that and let you, with your comments, fill that out.
Can I come back? You asked the question, so when does marriage start? Why did you ask that? What kind of options did you have in mind? What were you wondering about?
I guess my thought was that in our culture today, in the United States, two people are considered married once they, you know, have gone through the ceremony of marriage in a church with a pastor, preach, whatever, minister, and they've exchanged vows, and you know they dance and they kiss, and then people are married. And I don't know if I totally really see that is when two people are married. I guess I would say that they were married before then. Possibly. So, I don't know if two people have to go into a church to be married. Is what I guess I'm getting at.
Yeah, Yeah, I think that's fair. I mean, I would agree with what Jack has described. If I have made that commitment, then that's at the essence of marriage. Then you ask the question, well, what is a marriage ceremony for? I think formalizing, kind of articulating that commitment before a community of my friends and family is a meaningful thing. I mean, the community is kind of standing there with me saying, yes, we hear you. We're going to support you in this commitment you're making and that kind of thing. And it's meaningful. I remember, I've always thought this was good advice. Jack is the one who married Robbie and me. And when we were getting married, we were looking at kind of the hassle of it, and at a certain point we kind of thought, maybe we just we'll elope and just, go off and forget all of this stuff. And Jack didn't really make a big deal out of it, but he just looked at me and said, I think you'll regret it if you do that. I don't think that's what you want to do. And I think that's right, that there's something meaningful about doing that with the people that are significant in your life. But yeah, where the essence of it is in that commitment. And you want to tell your story about the...
Okay. But first, don't get any ideas. You elope. Okay, just so that's clear. Yeah, I had a Bible study up on a hippie commune in the Santa Cruz Mountains when I was a pastor in a church in California. And there was one couple who lived together. They just were basically husband and wife. And what was interesting about them is that they were professing Christians. They weren't married. They'd never been legally married. But they were believers, professing Christians. And what was strikingly different about them is on this hippie commune, your bed partner was different every night, except for them. And no one would have even dreamt of approaching them for a sexual encounter because they were, they were for each other. They were committed to each other. Well, the woman got pregnant and they came to me and said, we want to get married. Well, why did they want to get married? The reason they want to get married is because now that they were bringing a child into the world, all of a sudden it made a difference to them how the rest of society looked at them. Because it had implications for their child, anything from inheritance laws and all that kind of stuff. So I think they faced into the reality that you're not really, you haven't really finished keeping your promise to become one flesh. If you say, tell you what, I'll share my life with you and you alone completely, but let's not tell anybody else. Mm-hmm. Then you're cheating one another, and you haven't really fulfilled your promise to each other if you haven't shouted that to the world and said, we are together, leave us alone, we're for each other. Now in their little subculture that had become clear, but to the wider society, which has a way of insinuating into your existence, they had not made that clear, and that's what the legal realities are for. Now I was in a church at the time who had me under rules that if a couple are living together and they come to you to get married, you require them to live apart for the remainder of the time until the wedding ceremony. You don't allow them to live together. And I looked at that situation and I went, that's crazy. It's not that these people aren't married. It's that their marriage is incomplete. This wedding ceremony is not making them married. This wedding ceremony is just simply completing what they have now come to see as incomplete, and they want to fix that. And it just seemed to me it would have been silly to put them under that requirement. Everybody at the commune knew they were married. So who am I to say that they weren't?
I agree with what Jack's saying there. On the other hand, having lived through the 60s, where I remember the line in the Joni Mitchell song, we don't need no piece of paper from the city hall keeping us tied and true. This is Joni Mitchell, the serial monogamist, going from one relationship to another. I mean, keeping us tied and true as long as we want to hang around, and then we'll go be tied and true to somebody else. That we don't need no piece of paper really came down to we're really not getting married. We're not messing around with anybody else for a while until we get tired of each other is what it meant. And that's not marriage. And that's not, I don't put words in Jack's mouth, but I don't want to support the idea that, oh, they're really married. You know, marriage is insignificant. The piece of paper is insignificant. I don't think it is insignificant, actually. It would be a rare situation where the lack of that piece of paper wasn't problematic, I think. I think that may very well be in that case, but I would, most of the time, it indicates that, all you have to do is talk to people who have, they're in this committed relationship, and then they decide to get married, and all of a sudden everything changes because they realize they've made this commitment to this person. And why has everything changed? Because although they were saying they were committed to each other, they still felt this sort of loose, I'm still free. And it wasn't until they formalized it and said, okay, we're together. Now they start to feel the chains. Oh no, I tied myself here. Well, they feel tied because they weren't tied before. And that's quite common.
And I agree with that completely. It was faddish back in those days for people to change the vows instead of for as long as we both shall live, or for as long as we shall live, it's for as long as we both shall love. And they would change live to love. And I had a couple that weren't in the church. They just came off the street to get married, and I did premarital counseling, and we're going to have a wedding, and they wrote their vows for as long as we both shall live. And I said, you can go give those...
Live or love, excuse me.
I said, this is a Christian church. I'm a Christian pastor. You came to me because you wanted a Christian wedding. You're not... Those vows don't satisfy what Christian marriage is. You're welcome to go to the justice of the peace and say those vows if you want, but that doesn't represent what a Christian marriage is. So they kind of begrudgingly agreed to that, but they really slurred their words at the wedding ceremony. That was pretty interesting.
Based on the definition that you gave of marriage, leaving the home and making a promise to another person and becoming one, wouldn't that work between two men and two women? What is our only argument against homosexual marriage, the fact that God created a man and a woman and not two men?
Yeah, it comes down to the argument against homosexual marriage from a biblical perspective is, notice that I said in the biblical worldview, everything is teleological in nature. Everything has a structure. Everything has a design. Everything has a purpose. God could have made two creatures, both of which are capable of spawning children, and you just take turns. Or something like that. Why didn't he? Why the differences between male and female? And what I would argue is that it comes back to the ultimate purpose of marriage. It's a training ground. The reward of marriage and the difficulty of marriage is that the one I'm committing myself to know and come to respect and share my life with and give my life to completely so that we share the same life together is really one weird creature. They're radically different than I am. That goes both ways. Men mystify women, and women mystify men.
Amen.
We just don't... we just don't...
yes, sir?
We don't automatically get each other. And that's not a mistake in God's design. That's right exactly in line with God's design, is I want you to make a commitment to love across this difference that is more radical than any other difference you will ever find in human existence. Love across that. And in the process of loving across that, learn what love is. Learn what it means to respect. Learn what it means to serve. Learn what it means to be kind.
So there is a fair amount of fulfillment there.
Tremendous amount of fulfillment, yeah.
Jack, you said that the moral obligation is one of the promises we make in marriage. I was just wondering what the others are.
What, I'm sorry, one of the, what'd you say?
One of the promises we make in when we're getting married.
No, I'm sorry, I'm not being very clear. The marriage just is a moral obligation that I am taking on, that I am promising God, before God. I'm promising I'm going to, as Nancy put it, learn to be this kind of person to the one I'm marrying, that I will become one with them, and that I will make them the highest priority in my life, highest loyalty. So those are the two promises that I'm taking on as a moral obligation, is to become one flesh and to leave father and mother and cleave to my wife. And what I understand those to represent is sharing one life together in common with this person. That's what I'm promising. And secondly, I'm promising that no other human relationship will have my loyalty above my loyalty to my spouse.
And so I've talked to a lot of people that argue, like, I shouldn't get married until I have a really good career and I'm financially stable and can support and provide for another person. I guess how much of those kinds of obligations play into this moral obligation?
Well, this is where I'm a hopeless romantic, but I don't think any. I mean, yeah, granted, I'm realistic to know that economic pressures, for example, create incredible stress in a person's life and therefore can create incredible stress on a relationship. But if I really am making the commitment that marriage is, then you live through that stress together. So I don't think it's a matter of let's get myself in a position where I'm secure and certain and got myself figured out and then I'll be ready to get married. Well, no, you won't. I mean, it's going to be tough anyway. And granted, there you may be buying some trouble for yourself by making that decision in a context where your own life isn't altogether settled and sorted out. But okay, so face that together.
Can I add to that? I guess I'd just add that I agree with what Jack is saying, and I think one of the responsibilities that I'm taking on is to be an adult in that relationship. And so I think there is a component where being responsible about that, having some experience of living on my own perhaps, knowing that I can support myself and this other person, that we're going to support one another together, those kind of adult decisions are a part of marriage. And so I don't want to completely discount the grown-up part of that equation. But on the other hand, I think it's absolutely true that we live in a culture where you're supposed to have all your ducks in a row before you think you can do this. And I think that's really misleading because we're never going to have all our ducks in a row.
Yeah, but I want to ratify what she's saying. In the hopeless romantic in me is assuming you're an adult making that decision, and that's crucial. Yeah, if you do it as an adolescent kid just playing with marriage, you're in trouble. Yeah.
Jack, are you going to go over the examples of violation of this? Because I was curious about it.
Probably not, but if you see something there you want to comment on.
Well, you said it was addressed to a patriarchal society, and the first one you have is the wife listens to the father or mother above the husband. And I would think in a patriarchal society, it would be the husband listening to the mother and father over and above the wife. That struck me as curious. And I think a lot of these examples you gave could go both ways.
Yeah, I meant for them to go both
okay.
ways.
Yeah. Okay.
No, the point I was making is the pattern in the ancient world was a woman got married to a man and got absorbed into the man's family.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, take, for example, in the biblical record, Abraham sent his servant to go get a wife and bring him back for Isaac, and they just became a part of the larger family of Abraham and Sarah,
mm-hmm.
Isaac and Rebecca. Well, that was the pattern. Well, but notice the way Moses is writing it. A man is to leave father and mother and cleave to his wife.
Yes.
It's counter the cultural pattern of that time.
Yeah. But these violations that you have here on this list are kind of reflect more contemporary issues?
Yes.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Yeah. And they and each of them could be the other way around. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're mutual.
What I'm
saying for the wife could mm-hmm. be true of the husband and so on.
Are you going to talk about emotional adultery?
If I grant loyalty to someone other than my spouse, if I am, there are articles written a few years ago about literally emotional adultery when they finally realized this phenomenon in society where women would go into the workplace and they would form an emotional attachment with some man and vice versa. They didn't get physically involved. But like there's one article I read where the woman realized what had happened when some tragedy happened in her life and the first person she was inclined to call was this office mate, not her husband. Well, and she, I think, rightly recognized, wow, there's something happened here. Something is wrong here. It's not that she'd been physically unfaithful, but all of her emotional attachments had been transferred from her husband over to this other man. Well, that may not be physically adultery, but what we made a promise is we're in this life together. My fears are your fears. My hopes are your hopes. My dreams are your dreams. I'm going to so identify with you that everything that matters to you matters to me. And to the extent that I don't make that true, I'm not keeping my promise. And granted, all of us who are married have failed in that regard in significant ways. But it's a question of what do you see as the ideal that you're aiming at? What are you holding out as what you're obligated to try to fulfill?
I'm actually backing up to the question about purpose of marriage and the difference in gender, mm-hmm. sex. So you don't mention children at all, and right. you did say, you know, God could have done it in a different manner, but he didn't.
Right.
So do you feel that that reproduction is also part of the purpose of marriage as opposed to a homosexual relationship not being able to produce children?
Right. I think I'd put it differently. I don't think children are the purpose of marriage, but given that God created marriage with this purpose, he found no better place to bring children into the world than into exactly that kind of environment.
He says, be fruitful and multiply.
Right.
To Adam and Eve right off the bat.
Right.
But so that's just a second hand is what you're, is that what
well,
you're understanding?
It's part of the telos of marriage. It's part of the function, the design, the structure of what God intended marriage to be. And in that sense, it's the purpose. The only reason I hesitate is because if we call it the purpose of marriage and underline it, then childless couples are somehow not... Are out
but
of luck with it.
A part of it.
Yeah, it's certainly a huge aspect of what God is doing in marriage. Absolutely, and all kinds of studies show how important it is to have both a father and a mother in the raising of a child, because they bring different things to the relationship, and the nurture that comes more naturally to the mother, and I don't even have a word for it, but whatever it is we fathers bring to it, it must be worth something.
It's good.
It's good, yeah.
Jack, is this on?
Yeah.
Okay. It sounds like from what you're saying that it could be interpreted as that we should all want to get married and that we should all want to learn like through that, but... what about not being married?
Again, back in the 60s, especially in church culture, they talked about the gift of celibacy. And the way they understood the gift of celibacy was that God had so gifted you with an inclination that you didn't want to be married. Well, I don't think that's how Paul looks at it. Paul had such a gift as an apostle, and he saw it as a tremendous advantage, given what God had called him to do, to not be obligated with a moral obligation to a woman that takes a lot of work and a lot of energy to do right by the woman and right by the marriage relationship. that he was then free to go off and risk his life all the time, and he could probably ride motorcycles and, you know, all kinds of stuff like that. So there are distinct advantage of it, but I don't think Paul for a second is saying that he wasn't sacrificing something to do that he wasn't giving up something that he wanted.
What about, I've had conversations with different guys where they say that they think that Paul wishes that, I think there's a verse, I think in Romans, where he says, I wish that you all could be like me and not being married. I know you're getting your point wrong.
He's taught that chapter. Okay.
Well, I think this is from 1 Corinthians, this comes from, and part of the problem is that the entire section that he's, where this stuff is being said, I think has been misunderstood by people as to what it is that's going on. But I think the bottom line in that chapter, what Paul is dealing with, is a kind of asceticism that has crept into the Corinthian church. They have decided that sexuality in and of itself must be something less than holy. I mean, a truly holy person would not be involved in a sexual relationship. And so you have wives and husbands who have become Christians, and they say to their spouse, I'm too holy for that anymore. Okay, and largely what Paul's dealing with in that chapter is, no, God designed sexuality for marriage. So the idea that somehow you're above it, you're not understanding the way God has put things together. In that context, he does talk about singleness and the fact that the advantage that Jack is talking about. And he does have that phrase in there where several things that he says that indicates that he sees an advantage to it. But it's because he sees himself as, look, this is, we're in the time of the gospel, and there is this gospel work to be done, and I have been called to do this, and that, if I were married, I would have other obligations that would be rightly mine. I don't think he's looking down on those obligations or saying you shouldn't take those obligations on. And in fact, in other places, I think we see the Bible and Paul himself indicating that marriage is a good thing that God has intended for mankind. So, no, I don't think Paul is saying, he is very much not saying the most righteous thing to do is to not get married. But he is acknowledging that the decision to stay single for the sake of some service that you're going to perform or something like that could be an honorable thing to do.
But more specifically, in this conversation, they were saying that if he says, I wish that you could all be like me, that he thinks that that's better. I'm not sure.
Yeah, well,
because that certainly sounds like what it is saying. I wish that you could be like me.
Right, right. It all depends on what we mean by better. I don't think he's saying, see, there's a way of understanding that I wish that you could be like me that would imply that, well, if you're not all like me, then you've all kind of settled for second best, haven't you? Because I've got the best. I don't think that's what he means. I think he is saying, I have experienced some advantages that, in a way, I wish that you could all experience. I wish that you could all experience the single-minded pursuit of teaching the gospel that I have experienced. There's something in that that is really worthwhile. But the fact is that God has called people to marriage, and in the marriage relationship, you will have other joys, other fulfillments, and you know, as I look at, I can look at myself and think, I know perfectly well that being a married person has been a huge part of my having to grow up as a human being and as a Christian. And I understand what Paul's saying, but the fact is that, yeah, it would have been interesting to experience a life like Paul's, but that's not the life I was called to. And the life that I have experienced is not second best. It is a good life. It is the life that was appropriate for me to live. So I think he's not saying anything more than there is something about this that if you could have what I have, you would see that there's something good about it. But we could say back to Paul, yeah, and we see what you're saying, but I could also say that there's something about what I have that I could say, you know, if you had what I have, there's something here that I wish that you could have as well.
And he wouldn't deny that.
Right.
Could I jump in? I also want to just add that I admit it. Recently I watched The Sound of Music for about the 36th time in my life. But there's a scene where Maria, I hadn't seen in years, actually, quite honestly, but there's a scene where Maria comes back to the convent when she first decides or is afraid she might be in love with Captain Von Trapp. And she comes back into the convent, and finally the mother, the Reverend Mother, has this talk with her and discovers what's going on, and she says, "This is not where you hide. If God is putting your life there with that man and that family, that's where your calling is." And I think often we can take that view and what Paul is saying and kind of use it to say, oh, this is, God is calling me to be single. And I think often it's because it's really frightening to think about taking on the gift of marriage. And so that's what I would kind of underline, is that I think we really are made for marriage, and it's the unusual calling that is a calling to singleness. And even that is not necessarily, I mean, even though there are advantages to it that I can attest to, it's a very difficult calling. There are a lot of things that marriage brings that are really good gifts that being single, that makes not having that very difficult. Life is very difficult without having that kind of support. It's very difficult with that kind of support, too, from what I understand. But I guess I just want to underline that. I think we can really try to spiritualize, in a way, what is at heart a real understandable fear of what it is we would be taking on. So,
okay, a couple of really quick things. Number one, just talking about that single versus married and what your calling is thing, it seems like that gets back to what you were talking about earlier about you're not going to find fulfillment in marriage. You're going to find fulfillment in being with God, like in the, you know what I mean, in a much more eternal way, and how you can, kind of like what you were just saying, Nancy, you can, being married can help along that process, but you can, being single can also do that. Is that kind of, okay. And then my...
Just a short little, I don't think we're going to find fulfillment in this lifetime at all.
Right.
Okay.
Like, with God, lifetime to come right. Type of thing. Okay. That's what I was thinking. And then the other question was about emotional adultery, getting back to a little earlier. Are you saying that any disconnect of that kind from your spouse, like you were talking about earlier, where someone could practically drive their spouse to physical adultery so that they could get a situation like that? You used the example of a lady with a coworker, but would you agree that that could happen with not even with a person or with something else, just where they become totally, you know. Okay.
Yeah, I think women often feel like a man's job and vocation sometimes can be his mistress.
Right.
I think that's a very real phenomenon.
So it seems like the view that's common now for marriage is like you need to go find the right person for you, and when you find that person that like fits you and you fit them, then you marry them. So with what you guys are talking about, like, what would be the basis for, like, what would you look for in a person to marry them, and what would, like, show you that maybe you shouldn't marry that person, that you should?
because it's not, like, it doesn't sound like you're saying, like, there's the right person for you out there that God made, like, just one person for you, so.
If you promise not to get married in the next 6 weeks, I think that topic is a whole topic for a,
okay.
For Wednesday night.
It is? Well, okay, so you're going to talk about that again?
Briefly, it's more about making, for me, in deciding to marry Jody, it came down to, am I willing to commit myself to learn to be the right kind of man for this woman? And it was this woman in particular, because that's the one woman that was, that particular concrete woman was in view, not just an abstract woman. If I was willing to make that commitment to that woman, then she's the right woman for me. That, I'm sure that's not a totally satisfying answer, but that's what it, we'll explore that at okay. length in the in that session coming up.
Okay.
Any, we're kind of out of time, but are there any burning questions about marriage, since we're going to leave marriage now in the future weeks, any burning questions about marriage per se that you want to get out there before we put an end to this? Something about divorce?
Well, if no one's going to say anything. I guess the part of the outline that jumped out at me was where it talks about selfishness. And what I'm wondering is how two people can be selfless. Because it seems like... if two people are trying not to be selfish, then they're always going to let the other person get what they want, but then nothing would ever be would get done. You know, so like, no, you first. No, you first. So
marriage is a comedy routine.
What does that look like in marriage?
See, I really agree with what Jack is saying there, but I think we'd have to understand selfishness in a certain way. Selfishness does not mean a lack of concern for my own, myself and my own interests. It is, you know, it comes back to the commandment to love your neighbor as yourself. The idea meaning that I am willing to be as interested in your interests as I am in my own. But I am still interested in my own, and with two people, if they're really both interested in each other's welfare, then I mean, I could entirely, without selfishness, say to my wife, I would really like to do this thing. It would really make me happy if we went to this place, or I think it would be great. For her to know that that means something to me is not selfish of me to let her know that that's the case, and she might very well want to say, well, I would really like to do that because it doesn't matter much to me, but I know that would be really great for you, and let's go do that. And then she could say something to me on along the same lines. It's not that we're not interested in ourselves, but that we want to be on the other person's side as much as we are on our own side. So yeah, where selfishness comes into it is where I recognize this would be an important thing to my wife, but in order for me to go along with that, I'm going to have to pay a price. And I don't want to pay the price. I want to always have it my way. And that's where selfishness comes into it, where I'm fine for us to be one as long as I'm the one. You know. And that's selfishness. And that's what's going to destroy a marriage. But not a mutual recognition that we each have needs and desires and we are both interested in both of us finding a way to fulfill those things, that can be very, I mean, there's nothing really comic about it in that sense. I mean, it's a very, that's when marriage is at its best, is when you really feel like, you know, my partner in life here was actually thinking about me in this spot, you know, and that just, there's something about that that's really rewarding, and the opportunity to be thinking about them in the same way. But yeah, not, I, this, I think this is related to the question you're asking, but I always thought this was a very profound statement of C.S. Lewis's. He said, the Christian virtue is not self-denial. The Christian virtue is love. So it's not that I'm constantly doing without. It is that I am positively interested in the welfare of the other person. And that way, it's not, it's a fullness. It's a contributing to each other kind of thing.
That's a long answer, sorry.
Okay. Thank you very much for a very stimulating conversation.